welcome to the 4 o'clock hour show, Voices from the Front Lines. It's a segment on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. This is Manuel Criollo, your host. On today's show, we're going to have a real good show. First, from Washington, D.C., we'll have Eric Lotke from the Justice Policy Institute, who will be talking to us about their latest report on the growing disenfranchisement of blacks and Latino voters in the so-called swing states. The report is called Swing States, Crime, Prisons, and the Future of the Nation. And from San Diego, we will have Jose Bravo of the Southwest Network for Environmental and Economic Justice. He will give us his impressions on the weekend mobilization at the San Diego-Tijuana mobilization and the week of border actions that are organized by SNEJ for this upcoming week. And lastly, we will have Doug Heller from the electionwatchdog.org and the No on Proposition 64 campaign, who will be talking to us about the multi-million dollar supported Proposition 64 that is being supported by some of the largest transnational corporations in the state to limit the right of private parties to bring lawsuits against corporations. So we're going to start off the show today with Eric Lotke, who is the executive director at Justice Policy Institute, who will be talking to us about the growing disenfranchising of blacks and Latinos, in particular in the swing states. Here in the United States, we have over 7 million people who are either incarcerated or in some form of probation or parole. 7 million people. You know, this is like larger than 8 of the least populous states in this country combined. And so we have Eric on the line, and we're going to be talking to him about this latest report and just what are some of the impressions of what's happening in each of these battleground states out there as the election is sort of heating up for this last upcoming month. Thank you, Eric, for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Eric, give us here the lowdown of your report that came out last month, right, in late August, I believe. And can you give us just a breakdown of sort of what's the main purpose of you writing this report?
We're trying to call attention to the scale and what's going on in the U.S. justice system. As you were saying a minute ago, there are 7 million people under justice control in the United States. It's 2 million people, 2.1 million in prison and jail, and another 5 million people on probation or parole. And altogether, it's 7 million people, which is more people than in our 8 least populous states combined. As I sometimes like to say, organized differently, they would have 16 votes in the United States Senate. This is a huge number of people are under lock and key and under justice control in this country. And it's strange. We've sort of just taken it for granted. It's like the weather. You can't do anything about it. Oh, the United States, right. Rates of imprisonment 5 times as much as our peer countries like France and Germany and Japan and Canada. It's just all out of control. $157 billion is spent every year on this kind of thing, $167 billion on prisons, police, and all the rest of it. And at the same time that, well, back in the Willie Horton days, back in the Bush 1 campaign against Michael Dukakis, in the era of the Willie Horton advertisements when crime was just, that was when soft on crime became a label. And Bush the First labeled Michael Dukakis as soft on crime. And since then, the label has stuck and crime has been a real political hot potato. Nobody's willing to be labeled as soft on crime. We've just kind of, Democrats and Republicans alike, taken for granted that you can't talk about it. And every year, the prison population goes up another couple of percent. And so during this election season, when nobody is talking about crime, nobody is talking about prison, nobody is talking about how this money is being spent or how it could be spent differently, we kind of said, hey, wait a minute. Let's have a look at this. This is an important domestic issue. It's $167 billion. We'll talk later about how all these people are losing their right to vote and all the rest of it. Somebody should be talking about this. And so we did a report on crime in prisons and things that are going on just now.
That sounds great. I mean, you know, I mean, I think the centrality of race is so important and so embedded in you know, I've been reading the executive summary, and I also have breezed through the actual report, and just to me, it's just so, you know, glaring when you look at the statistics of who's in prison. I mean, I think it reaches sort of the nature of the code word of crime, I think. You know, when politicians speak of crime, I mean, I think it is on some level a code word for, let's, you know, the sort of problematics of blacks and Latinos in this society and how can we lock them up. I mean, you know, if you look at, you know, some major statistics here in California, who's being locked up, if you looked at the folks who are being locked up at a higher percentage rate for three strikes, it's, you know, pretty glaring that it's black folks and Latinos. And, you know, if you even look at, I was reading a report from the ACLU, and basically they reported that in 2012, I believe, there will be the same amount of black men in prisons, in the U.S. prisons, compared to at the height of enslaved men during 1864, during, you know, sort of the waning years of slavery in this country.
Right. We don't even have to project to the future to see how bad it is. Right now, there are twice as many African-American men in their early 30s who have been to prison. They've spent at least a year in prison. Twice as many have been to prison as have obtained a bachelor's degree. So 22.4% have been to prison. 12.5% of the black men have a bachelor's degree. This is black men in their 30s. By the time you're in your early 30s, you more or less, you know, that's the time when more people who are going to get a bachelor's degree have one already. Mm. In prison, there's eight times as many African Americans as whites and Latinos. I believe it's four times as many. Don't have that number on the tip of my fingers for you.
Mm.
But the disparities are very significant. And then in California, we see them especially when we start looking at three strikes, you're out, and the application of the three strikes laws, where the African Americans are being brought in deeper and deeper. There's more African Americans arrested than there are in the general population, more in the prison than get arrested, more strikers, more second strikers, more third strikers. It keeps on getting deeper and deeper for the African Americans as they go further in. For the Latinos, there are similar disparities, especially from the population to the arrest phase. It levels out somewhat as you move into the prison population and then the strikers, but still the Latinos are in California prisons, 80-some percent, again, don't have the number on my fingertips, 80-some percent higher than the whites relative to their population. By the way, our organization is going to release a whole racial breakdown of California three strikes and you're out law this coming Wednesday, where how much the black-white disparities, the Hispanic-white disparities, whether it's 80% or 85% of stuff that I'm not telling you right off the top of my head right now, we're going to release all of that for real on this coming Wednesday, and we'll do a county-by-county breakdown. We'll see how things are different in Los Angeles County and San Francisco County and Kern County and all the rest of
that. That'd be great, given that, you know, there's going to be a major vote on a proposition that's coming up here, Proposition 66, that would, you know, relatively amend certain portions of three strikes. And I think that's will be a positive part of the debate, given that, you know, at times folks in who are in favor of pushing Prop 66, you know, sometimes shy away from talking about race, given, again, sort of the, you know, unfortunately, I would say the, you know, racist nature of a lot of the electorate here in California. Even though a lot of folks believe it's a very liberal state, we've seen our sort of share of pretty regressive propositions that have been passed on the state. And I think that should be a positive piece to the debate that you bring out with your report. So, Eric, let's talk a little bit about just some of the issues that was raised in the report. Let's talk about the Republican states. And not surprisingly, in some of the Republican states, what's the outcome of the tie of imprisonment and disenfranchisement in those states,
the so-called Republican states? In this report, we looked at 10 years. It was, generally speaking, 1993 to 2002, the most recent 10 years of data that was available. And what we found was that the rates of incarceration, the increase in the rates of incarceration over those 10 years, the amount that things changed during that 10-year stretch, 1993 to 2002, the Republican states increased their rate of incarceration twice as much as the Democrat states. The Republicans had twice as big a increase in the rates of incarceration, but the Democratic states had twice as big a decline in crime during the 1990s. So the R state's prison growth, their rate of incarceration went up 31.7% compared to 16.8% in the Democrat states. But the Democrat states, the FBI index crime, which is the catch-all for all of the major crimes, murder, robbery, rape, burglary, and so forth, the index crime in the Democrat states fell during that period 37.3%, and in the Republican states it fell by only 16.9%. The crime went down nationally. It went down everywhere in the 1990s, and we could talk about why that is. It's the aging of the baby boom and the economic boom, that kind of stuff. But it went down more and faster in the Democrat states than it did in the Republican states. So that was one very interesting finding when we sliced and diced the data by party label.
But yet even in some of these sort of so-called, I mean, just to name some of the Republican states, I mean, we're talking about like Texas, Mississippi, Alabama, pretty much almost all the South and most of the Midwest. In the Democrat states, we're talking about states like California, New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts. But, you know, the interesting thing about that whole debate around, you know, that crime is actually falling and yet the rate of imprisonment is also high. Let's you know, when you look at the Rockefeller laws in New York, that have sort of higher sort of sentences for people of color, there's a big disparity in between the type of drugs you get caught between cocaine compared to, like, say, crack or some other sort of illicit drugs. Here in California, you know, in that period between 93 and now, you know, we did have the Proposition 184, which is the three strikes, and we also saw Proposition 21 that, you know, sort of further further increase sort of certain penalties on young people, especially people who are under 18. So, you know, why do you think that, you know, while, you know, I know a lot of analysts talk about there's a fall of crime, yet, you know, both Republicans and Democrats continue to sort of push this sort of scare tactic among a lot of the electorate out there?
The prisons are very interesting. Prisons go up when crime goes up, and people say we need it to control crime. And prisons go down when crime goes down, and people say, thank goodness we're doing it to control crime. And so prisons just kind of go up no matter what. And they've been going up for the last 25 years in America. Our rate of incarceration was normal by historical and international standards. We have data going all the way back to the 1860s, and we were more or less normal at rates of 100 per 100,000, roughly up and down a bit year by year. And then in roughly 1980, things went crazy. Now we're up in the high 400s. Per 100,000. So we've quadrupled our prison populations in these last 25 years, and they just keep on going up. When crime goes up, prisons go up. When crime goes down, prisons go down. It's a little bit interesting. You talk about California and New York in particular, which are two big Democratic states, but they've gone very different directions in recent years. New York is actually, and by the way, as I talk about the upward trends, it is softening. In recent years, the curve is flattening. And in some places, it's actually starting to go down a little bit. New York, it actually went down. They had a decrease in their rate of incarceration relative to their population over that 10-year stretch. Hmm. Just a few people, but it's actually a negative rate increase or decrease, I guess you call it, negative increase. It's a decrease. They're flattening and going down, mm-hmm, in New York. California, especially with the three strikes influx, really grew its rate of incarceration during that 10-year stretch. So New York went down 4%, and California went up 17%. And yet, New York had a bigger decrease in crime than California did. So it's a little sloppy getting that out, But the punchline is New York had a small, it had a negative shift in prison population. Their prisons went down, and California went up, way up, especially with three strikes, but New York had a better decline in crime than California did. So, you know, there's a little bit of shifting around the edges now, where not everything is always going up, and the places that are going down aren't necessarily suffering for it. And so there are a few legislators in some places that are being a little bit more, I don't know, even know if courageous is the word. You know, like in Michigan where they abolished their mandatory minimum. And I want to say that's courageous. In Maryland where the Republican governor just signed a big treatment not prisons bill, which is great, treatment not prisons. But California led the way on that with Prop 36 a few years ago, which passed very significant political support. And running around the country now, mandatory minimums poll badly, and treatment and prevention poll quite well. And so some of these legislators are catching on to that people are frustrated with the same old get-tough policies. They want to be smart. They want to use their money wisely. And so in Michigan, the Republican governor is abolishing the mandatory minimums. And in New Jersey, again, it's a Republican governor who signed a treatment, not jail bill. And the California voters led the way with Prop 36, the treatment, not jail initiative, a few years back, and they have another opportunity to say yes to the long prison terms, but only for the repeat violent offenders we want. When we passed three strikes back then, we meant serious violent crime. We didn't necessarily mean everybody. And so there's 40-some thousand California residents who are locked up under three strikes who might not be what the voters had in mind the first time around, and now the voters have an opportunity to say exactly what it was that they meant.
Right. Could we get into sort of the impact of, you know, incarceration in the so-called swing state? Again, for folks, I mean, I'm pretty sure it's on the news every day, but the swing states are sort of these very important key states where both Republicans and Democrats are basically putting most of their resources to try to win the vote. Increasingly, the votes primarily to, I think, target primarily sort of, you know, the NASCAR dads and, you know, those soccer moms in white suburbia. But can we talk a little bit about those states and what sort of what did the report talk about those swing states in terms of the rate of incarceration and disenfranchisement?
Well, the swing states turn out to be, in some ways, not especially interesting because they were right between the D's and the R's. So the Republican states had the bigger increase in prisons, and the Democrat states had the bigger decrease in crime, and the swing states run in the middle. So some go some way, some go the other way. There's no clear trend. One of the things that we found was that was pretty pronounced was higher education. When we compared prison spending to higher education spending, it really left out in the swing states that the swing states were, their increased higher education spending during that 10-year stretch, their increase in higher education, or their increase in prison spending was five times as high as their increase in higher education spending. So that really stood out, that they were spending a lot more money for prisons. That was growing five times as fast as their growth in higher education as a whole. Then when we looked at it piece by piece, for example, we looked at Pennsylvania and Ohio, which are two states that have a good deal in common, and they're both important swing states. And Pennsylvania has been continuing to push its prison policies, has been clamping down on parole, and has been increasing its length of stay for people who are locked up for all different kinds of crimes. And so their prison population has been pushing up. And similarly, if all of the revenue sources and all of the money spending show that they're spending more on prisons than other things, there, Pennsylvania in particular spent their increased rate of spending on higher education, on prisons, was 14 times as much as it was on higher education. So Pennsylvania increased its prison spending 14 times as much as it increased its higher ed spending during those years. Compare it to Ohio, which has really been going the opposite direction. They've been accelerating their parole, especially for the bottom end offenses, the low level, the nonviolent folks, the drug addicts. They've been saying these folks don't need to be serving long times. So when you're serving, let's say a 3 to 9, we'll get you out closer to 3. When you're serving a 5 to 10, we're going to get you out closer to 5. Especially the low-level, low-risk, nonviolent kinds of folks, and especially the people who have been participating in programming while they're in prison, which they've made much more available in Ohio, education, drug treatment, and all the rest of it. You go in drug addicted, you come out faster and better programmed in the Ohio prison. Pennsylvania hasn't been doing that, and Pennsylvania has been showing that their prison populations have been coming down, and their costs also reflect how they've been, or their expenditures reflect those policy choices. So that's what we found when we looked at, let's say, Pennsylvania and Ohio. And there were similar stories to be told. We went to the northern Midwest, and we looked at Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. And we found that Michigan really stood out with its repeal of those mandatory minimums. Again, Republican leadership there. And so they've been moderating their prison sentences, and then the expenditures moderate along with it. Wisconsin has gone the other direction. Wisconsin had a 95% increase in incarceration during that 10-year stretch, which was much more than anybody else had. And it had so many prisons they had to send people out of state even. So that's kind of what's been going on in terms of the swing states.
This is Manuel Criollo, and I'm talking to Eric Lotke from the Justice Policy Institute. We're talking about a report that they have called Swing States, which talks about sort of the connection between, you know, prisons, crime, disenfranchising in the swing states. Obviously, it's a very important discussion, given that these are sort of the battleground states that folks are going to. Let's get into the question of disenfranchisement, Eric. I was reading here in the report that you've stated that there's over 4.7 million people in the United States who are denied the right to vote as a result of sort of felony conviction. One of the biggest states that I've noticed here is Florida in particular. I know in the last elections there was the big scandal around not only with people who have been disenfranchised by this type of law, but more importantly, almost everybody who had even the same name, like Robert Johnson, was also even denied the right to vote. Can you give us a little bit, just a breakdown of those 4.7 million, what's the racial breakdown of that? And talk about specific states, I mean, like key states like Florida and New Mexico, and what's the breakdown there in terms of disenfranchisement of voters?
They were very aggressive in purging the rolls in Florida in 2000, I think much too aggressive, and they got a lot of people who should not have been disenfranchised. Altogether in Florida, there were 827,000 people who were purged from the rolls as a result of a disenfranchisement, or I should say a claimed disenfranchisement, because a claimed felony conviction, because there were many errors. So 827,000 of voters in Florida lost their right to vote in the 2000 election, and you might remember the Bush margin of victory was 537 votes. So, you know, obviously would have made a big difference. Some people did an analysis of electoral trends in Florida. How many of those 827,000 actually would have voted? Not all of them.
Mm-hmm.
How many are black? How many are Latino? What are the voting characteristics and trends? How many are D versus how many are R? And what they decided when they looked at all of that was that likely Al Gore would have won in Florida by 90,000 votes had those 827,000 people not been disenfranchised.
And I'm reading here of the 827,000 folks who were disenfranchised in Florida, that's almost comparable to what's combined for all the other disenfranchised folks in the other so-called Democratic states, right?
Right. 827,000 people disenfranchised in Florida alone, 846,000 disenfranchised in all of the Democratic states. And all of the Republican states, including Florida, or no, I'm sorry, excluding all of the Republican states, 2 million people.
So
Republican states, 2 million.
In Republican states, 2 million folks.
2 million people. And 8.6% of the African Americans. 8.6% of the African Americans in the Republican states have just plain lost their right to vote.
Eric, did you say, what's the percentage of the 4.7 million? What's the racial breakdown on that number? And that's the number of disenfranchised folks in the whole country. What's the breakdown of race in those numbers?
That's the number, right, 4.7 million mm-hmm. is nationally.
Right.
1.8 million are African Americans.
That's close to half, right? A little under.
And then 1.4 million are black men, totaling 13% of African American men have lost the right to vote. So 13% of African American men have lost the right to vote. And I have to open a parenthesis here. 11% of blacks in their 20s are literally in prison or jail every day. They're not even members of free society in any way. 11% of the black men in their 20s and 30s. So close that parenthesis, leave that one on the side, because that's a different insult to liberty.
You're saying the combination of folks, both who have already done their so-called time, but then also folks who are also in prison who... That's not even part of the debate in some sense, you're saying.
Right. So, but back to the big picture, the Democrat states 846,000 disenfranchised, mm-hmm. the Republican states 2 million disenfranchised, and the swing states altogether 1.7 million disenfranchised.
Wow.
Very disproportionately African American.
Eric, where can folks reach out to you and get a copy of the report? And I know, as you were saying, you'll be publishing a new report on three strikes and race here in California around the three strikes. Can you give folks your information, please?
Come to our webpage, www.justicepolicy.org. Again, it's justicepolicy.org. And there's a report on there called Swing States, which is much of what I've been talking about, especially the disenfranchisement and the focus on the swings. And there are, at present, two reports there about three strikes you're out in California. One is a general overview that shows how many people are in there for violent crimes, how many are nonviolent crimes, how much money is being spent, what has gone on in the performance of this law over the last 10 years. And then another one focuses on three strikes you're outlaws in general and shows how California is out of step from all of the other states with three strikes laws. Starting on Wednesday, there will be yet another study on three strikes that shows racial disparities in the application of the law and how it has been differently applied depending on where people live and what is the color of their skin.
Well, thank you very much, Eric Lotke. This was Eric Lotke of the Justice Policy Institute. We'll be right back with Jose Bravo of the Southwest Network for Environmental and Economic Justice talking about this weekend's mobilization at the San Diego-Tijuana. Stay tuned, and we'll be back.